I hope you sensed Courtney's passion for this. I hope you've sensed Mike's passion for it over the last few weeks. There's nothing we're doing that is more important than what we're doing with our teens and our kids. I mean, I think if you want to judge our church, it shouldn't be based on our worship teams or the preaching. I think it should be based on, is good news being preached to the poor? Is the kingdom being expanded? And how are we loving on the ones that are most at risk within our community? And those are our kids. And so if you're not serving them in one capacity or another, I really believe it's obligation's not the right word. But I do think that the Lord has given them to us, and there are responsibilities, probably a better word. I think these children are all of our responsibilities. So encourage you, if you're not serving with us in one of our children's ministries teams, let Court know on that card, and she will reach out to you and get you involved at one level or another. We are coming up on Easter Sunday, and so maybe if you're doing the math on this, you're trying to figure out how we're going to land this plane. We've been in this series for a little while now. We'll circle back to that in a few minutes. Also encourage you, please get your Good Friday tickets and Easter tickets. They're going really quick, and I want to make sure you hear the end of the story. All right, with a helicopter buzzing over our heads, have you ever tried to come to your own agreement with God? Like, tried to cut a deal with him? I know I shouldn't do that. After all, I'm a pastor. I understand the theology about all of that, right? But there are some things that I find I want so much. And to the best of my knowledge at this point, they're not really things. I hope I've matured to the place where most of the time, most of the deals I'm trying to cut with God aren't really about me. Most of the time, in fact, I saw myself trying to cut one with God this week as I was working on it. Most of the time in my heart, when I'm trying to cut a deal with God, it's for my kids, or it's about my kids, and it's about their health or about their happiness or something that's going on in their life. But again, you know, if you peel the onion back a little bit, you wind up even in there at my own happiness. So even in my most selfless moments, the self is still alive and well. Most of these deals that I sense my heart still tries to cut, in my more spiritually mature years, I never really speak them out loud anymore. But there is within me, and I know it, I can feel it trying to rise up, and maybe it's in you too, where in my heart I'm like, God, please, like I'll do anything. Do you have that sometimes where you're like, well, what do you want? What would it require? What would I have to do to get what it is that I want? When you're younger, it's kind of like you lay out the conditions. You're a little more bold, probably a little more immature in your faith, and you're like, God, if you'll do this, then it's usually things that you'll stop doing, right? God, if you'll do this, then I won't do that anymore, I promise. Or sometimes we come at it from the other side, kind of in our attempt to control God. The first way we're trying to bribe God, as if somehow God would go, oh, good, I'm very happy now because you're not going to do that anymore, right? And the other way, we try to control them, right? Which is, God, I'll stop doing this because I want you to do that. I've been following Jesus for nearly 40 years now. Over time, those prayers have morphed and changed. They've matured, but they have one thing in common. Do you know what it is? They don't seem to work. Like, I've prayed a lot of them. Often later, right? Like, I was just praying one this week. I wanted something for one of my kids, and I was praying about it. And I felt my heart saying, well, try to cut a deal with God. Most of the time, I'm glad they haven't worked out, right? I'm spiritually mature enough to know that some of the stuff, like I can look in the rearview mirror and go, some of the stuff that I wanted, I'm glad God didn't come through on for me at the time. It would have messed my life up, right? And then I guess the other side is, if you ever got to the place where you thought you could control God by making deals, how dangerous would that actually be? I mean, where would the end of that be? This is the kind of thinking, right, the kind of deal making that led to child sacrifice altars that you can find all around the ancient lands. People would pay any kind of price eventually if they thought they could control God, if they could get the right deal from him. God does not work that way. It's not that God's against cutting a deal. In fact, I think what you'll see this morning is God is the ultimate deal maker. It's his primary relational mechanism.
It's that God is not really interested in our deals, as selfless as they may seem on their surface. And key point, there's already a deal in place. And that's where we pick up our story this morning in today's edition from Cradle to Grave, where we've been following Jesus best we can, step by step, from his manger in Bethlehem to his coming crucifixion in Calvary. And we've attempted, almost laughingly, to try to fit 3 years of ministry into 3 months of Sundays. It hasn't been easy. But we're going to pick up our story where we left off last week, with Jesus telling his disciples on three straight occasions, really, chapter by chapter, they were fighting with each other in each case over who was going to be the greatest. Each time, Jesus, while they're arguing over who's going to be greatest, Jesus is saying, I hate to interrupt you with this news, but I'm on my way to Jerusalem to die for you. To inaugurate a new deal, actually. To cut a new deal that would enable his new kingdom. Now, if we could throw the map up there, it's been about 2.5 years at this point in our story since we first picked up the story of Jesus in his adult ministry right here at the top of the Dead Sea where that blue dot is. That's where John the Baptist, you can leave that up, Lauren. That's where John the Baptist was drawing thousands of folks out of the city and even more controversially out of the temple just to the left about a day's journey away in Jerusalem, out to the banks of the Jordan River, declaring that everyone, Jew and Gentile alike, had a need for repentance, to change the way they think, John would explain. And then when they change the way they thought about their religion and about their worldview, then that they would need to change the way they live. Because the existing religious system in Israel was broken and had become corrupt. A new king and a new kingdom was dawning. And it was going to close the book on temple-based Judaism with its laws and priests and sacrifices. Well, after John was arrested by the people whom this kingdom threatened, the strange bedfellows that are made by politics and religion of the day, Jesus goes back north to his hometown of Nazareth, which is just, if you see the word Galilee there, it's just to the south and to the west. He winds up spending most of his time in the town of Capernaum, in the area of Capernaum, around the Sea of Galilee. Most of the stories you know about Jesus take place up there by the Sea of Galilee, on its banks and on its shores and in the towns that surround it. But as we've seen, Jerusalem and the temple and the feasts of the faith were things that frequently drew Jesus back to the city, as it had again where we pick up our story today with John. Jesus makes his way back down to Jerusalem. John writes that then came the festival of dedication at Jerusalem. Or does anybody know what the festival of dedication, how it's commonly known today? Hanukkah. So it's Hanukkah time, right? It was winter. And Jesus was in the temple courts walking in Solomon's colonnade. So Jesus is back down in Jerusalem. If you remember, the scriptures often say he went up to Jerusalem because of the elevation. John tells us that he's in the area in the temple known as Solomon's colonnade or Solomon's porch. Could we show everybody what a model of that looked like? That is Solomon's colonnade, Solomon's porch. That sets the scene for the story you're about to hear. Some background on this. There was a Jewish historian. We've been quoting him along the way, kind of getting extra biblical historical sources for our story. Josephus, he described Solomon's porch this way. He says there was a porch without the temple overlooking a deep valley supported by walls of 400 cubits, about 600 feet, about 60 stories tall, made of four square stone, very white. The length of each stone was 20 cubits, and the breadth six. This is a pretty big place where Jesus is, and there's a lot of people around. John, and it's Hanukkah. John writes that the Jews who were gathering there, the Jews who were there gathered around him, likely some of the temple leaders, saying, "How long will you keep us in suspense? If you're the Messiah, tell us plainly." And Jesus answered, "I did tell you, but you did not believe. The works I do in my Father's name testify about me." In other words, I haven't just told you guys this. I have shown you, not just with words, but with signs.
And they knew about the signs. You'll see about that shortly. They had been meeting about the signs. They were concerned about what these signs that Jesus was up to. We call them, we see them, we read about them and think of them as miracles. They saw them as signs. They weren't sure they liked what these signs were saying. Jesus says to them what I think he says to you and I. I'm not asking you to blindly have faith. I'm not asking you to have faith for faith's sake. He's going, look, I want you to look at the evidence. Be smart. Judge for yourself. Don't check your brain at the store. We're saved by faith, but we believe at least in part because of proof. Jesus is going, I haven't just spoken to you about these things. I've shown them to you. I haven't spoken about a kingdom that's coming. I've proved to you that it is breaking through. But here's the deal, and you and I know this. And haven't we all done this? Can't we turn a blind eye? Can't you explain away almost anything that you have to in order so that you might not have to change something that you like or lose something that you love? Can't you come up with any reason to go, well, and of course, as usual, especially when he was down in the area of Jerusalem, when he was in the temple, you know, Jesus was a little bit more of a hometown hero up north. In the temple, he was never readily received. If you remember the first time he went in there, 2 years earlier, about 2.5 years earlier than this moment, he had cleared the temple out. He begins to tell them more and more about who he is. They get angrier and angrier to the point where they begin to try to stone him right there in the temple. John says that then Jesus went back across the Jordan to the place where John had been baptizing in the early days, and he stayed there and many people came to him. They said, quote, though John never performed a sign, all that John said about this man was true. And in that place, many believed in him. Crowds and controversies. Those two things are following Jesus everywhere. And it is at this point, just outside of Jerusalem, where Jesus gives these temple leaders the sign that they said they were looking for and the sign that they hoped they would never get. And it was also the sign that would mark the end of these 3 years, in a sense, of us following him. Now, there is an entire sermon series that could be preached on the sign that starts the dominoes falling. There's no time for that now, but many of you know the story. Jesus heads back towards Jerusalem, and just outside of the city, he winds up in the town of Bethany, where he knows everyone will know what's going on. He told his disciples we're heading back to Bethany, and they reminded him, you know, we just got chased out of there. Don't you remember they were trying to stone you in the temple? And Jesus says, we're going anyway. Why is he heading to Bethany? Why is he going to a place where he knows that controversy awaits? Because he had gotten word that his friend Lazarus had died. And Jesus, quite intentionally, after some waiting, decides he's going to raise his friend Lazarus from the dead. And if you know the story, it's not like Lazarus was recently dead. Jesus heard that he was dying, and Jesus purposely waited. And Lazarus is not just like flatlined for a moment dead at this point. Lazarus is embalmed and entombed dead. Lazarus is funeral over, life is beginning to take shape again, dead. If you know the story, right? Jesus, he waits on purpose. He waits so long to go, 4 days, that his sisters Mary and Martha were worried. Jesus goes, let's go. I'm going to show you. I'm going to give you the sign that the kingdom has come, right? And I am the king of this new kingdom. And he says, open the grave. And does anybody remember what his sister Martha said? Don't do that. It's going to smell. That's as dead could be. Why does Jesus wait so long? Because he wants to give them the sign he knew they both wanted and didn't want. Jesus wanted to give them the sign that he also knew would be the beginning of his end. In fact, as he raises Lazarus, he does so with a prayer. He has a short conversation with his dad. He says, Father, I thank you that you've heard me. I know that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they might believe that you sent me. And with that, he tells Lazarus to come out of his grave. And he does. And the sign works like crazy.
John writes, therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary to comfort her, right, and had seen what Jesus did, believed in him. I would imagine they did. And this is important for John. You'll see it over and over if you read through John's account of Jesus. This concept of see and believe. Many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did. What did Jesus tell the temple rulers? Not only have I told you, I've shown you. See and believe. He goes on, but some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. The chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. What are we accomplishing, they asked. Here is this man performing many signs. I love this. Many signs. Same guys a few weeks earlier had denied to Jesus that they even knew who he was, right? But now, you know, this is too much. What are we even accomplishing by waiting any longer? This guy just keeps performing all these signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone's going to believe in him. Why? Because they will see and believe. And then the Romans will come and take away both. And here it is, guys. Our temple and our nation. Our temple and our nation. If you were here last week, our religion and our politics. Bad bedfellows. The conservative Pharisees who held power and control and authority through their legalistic religious practices. And the liberal Sadducees who held power by making peace and getting along with Rome. And the propped up puppet King Herod that Rome had installed, right? Whose power was granted to him as long as he did what he was told and kept the peace. If we don't do something, it's all going to go away. Now, last week, if you were here, it was Jesus' followers. You remember it was Jesus' followers last week that wanted to make him king by force. And Jesus wanted nothing to do with it. He escaped away. They misunderstood him. They misunderstood the kind of king he came to be, the kind of kingdom he came to establish. This week, it's the opposing forces, right, who fear that he's going to become king by force, and they also want nothing to do with it. And so John tells us from that day on, they plotted to take his life. And therefore, Jesus no longer moved about publicly among the people of Judea. Instead, he withdrew to a region near the wilderness, to a village called Ephraim, about 13 miles, Ephraim was, about northeast of Jerusalem, not that far away, where he stayed with his disciples. But not for long. Because when it came time for the Jewish Passover, many went up from the country to Jerusalem for their ceremonial cleansing before the Passover, and they kept looking for Jesus. And as they stood in the temple courts, they asked one another, "What do you think? You think he's coming? Is he going to show up? What gate do you think he's going to pass through? He's going to flip the temple, flip the tables again?" But the chief Pharisees had given orders that anybody who found out where Jesus was should report it so that they might arrest him. It was time for the Passover, and everyone everywhere knew Jesus was on his way to Jerusalem. He had to be. It was Passover after all, and everyone was looking for him. Why? I like this. John says, meanwhile, a large crowd of Jews found out that Jesus was there and came not only because of him, but also to see Lazarus, who he had raised from the dead. What John is telling us is that Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem for Passover. And on the way, guess where he stops? Back in Bethany, back where he had raised Lazarus from the dead. He's on his way to Jerusalem for Passover, and the crowds who are also on their way to Jerusalem for Passover, they're all stopping by in Bethany too. Why? Because Lazarus has become a tourist attraction, right? Everybody, the word is out on the streets, and people don't want to just see Jesus, right? I mean, imagine this. They want to see the guy that, this is a historical documented story. They want to see the guy that was dead for 4 days. I wonder what he looks like. I wonder if he still smells, right? And so things are like out of control now. The whole thing is just, this Lazarus thing has really set the town on edge. And so the chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well. Did you ever notice that one before? For on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and believing him. That's how out of control this sign had become. Many of you know the story. Jesus leaves Bethany. He comes into Jerusalem.
It's a famous story. It's known as the triumphant entry. Some of us refer to it as Palm Sunday. That we'll commemorate it next week. Jesus makes his way into town. This is his third Passover in ministry. The crowd that was with him was there, right? The crowd that had been in Bethany followed him there. There was a crowd that had been waiting there, wondering, I wonder if he's coming. And then the word got out that he was coming. And everybody runs out to the roadside. And they begin to cry out, Hosanna, 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 which is this guttural cry. It's really more of a plea. Save us now. Save us now. And they explain how they want to be saved. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. It's a religious claim. Blessed is the King of Israel. It's a political claim. Jesus, be the great Messiah of our people, Israel. Save our religion, save our culture, save our people, save our nation. I mean, it was equal parts exciting for the Jewish people on the streets as it was threatening to everyone in charge of those things, the temple and the palace. John said the moment culminates this way. Now the crowd that was with him when he called Lazarus from the tomb and raised him from the dead continued to spread the word, which again, if you see a guy that was 4 days dead come out of his tomb, you probably would. Many people, because they had heard that he performed this sign, went out to meet him. And so the Pharisees said to one another, see, this is getting us nowhere. Look how the whole world has gone after him. And I couldn't help but reflect on that this week. I went to grab something to eat, and I went for a little walk around Chester before I picked up my meal. And as I walked down Main Street in Chester, I passed by the Roman Catholic Church, and then I passed by the Congregational Church, and then I passed by the Presbyterian Church, and I thought about, you know, that our church was just down the road. Look at how the whole world has gone after them. And so it was Passover. That's why the people were all there. And this was a Passover like any other Passover, right? Like, in one way, it was a solemn Passover because the people of Israel were still being, you know, they weren't enjoying their land that had been promised to them, that the Passover had kind of been representative of that promise. Rome was an occupying force in their land. But in another way, it was a very exciting Passover because of all of the promise that had kind of like latched on to Jesus. Everyone on the parade route thinks this is where Jesus is finally going to announce, well, the new deal. The one that they had been waiting for. The one that if they knew the scriptures, and many of them did, that had been promised. John had been talking about it. Jesus had been proclaiming it. A new king, a new kingdom. The prophets, we looked at this, had been foretelling the day, right? When this new king with a new kingdom would announce a new covenant. Remember, right? It was Moses who God established the covenant they were living under, right? It was an if-then covenant. It was a bilateral covenant between God and a nation. If the nation would obey, then God would bless the nation, and the nation would become for God a kingdom of priests, mediating between the people and man, showing the world what God looks like. But if they did not obey, he would not. If you remember, right, Moses told them right before they went, it was Moses' dying speech, right before they went into the land that had been promised to them, right? Moses said, I know when you get in there, I know what's going to happen. I know you're not going to obey. And he foretold of a new covenant with a new sign. No longer would it be an outward circumcision, the sign of the old covenant. He said, the Lord will circumcise your hearts and the hearts of your descendants so that you might, listen to the language here, it's important. So that you may love him with all of your heart and with all of your soul and live. Through Ezekiel, God had said, the day would come when I will give you a new heart. I'll put a new spirit in you. I'll remove your heart of stone, right? Kind of reflective of the stone tablets Moses had been given relating to God through the law. And I'm going to give you a new heart of flesh. And I'm going to put my spirit in you. And I will move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. No longer will it be drudgery. It'll come out of a transformed nature. And of course, Jeremiah wrote that the days are coming when I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel and with the people of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they broke my covenant, though I was a, listen to the language, though I was a husband to them, declares the Lord. And so what better time to introduce this new covenant than the Passover celebration of that old covenant? The Passover celebration, the remembrance of when God had led his people out of captivity in Egypt. And so Jesus sends the disciples ahead out of all of this mess. He sends them ahead of the crowds and goes, I want you to go prepare a place just for you and I to share the Passover meal. And somehow, I don't know, but somehow he sneaks away and he gathers with them at one point. And at a very specific point in a very orchestrated meal and celebration, he changes everything. Luke writes that he took bread and he gave thanks and he broke it and he gave it to them saying, this is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. Which is a startling statement. You and I have heard it so many times. Almost every time communion is handed out, right? You've heard that statement. Do this in remembrance of me. But during that Passover gathering, that was anything but what was expected. They were used to do this in remembrance of. That's what we do at Passover. All of the elements have some meaning. All of the elements help us to remember. What do they help us to remember? Jesus, they would have said that. What are you talking about? When we gather at Passover, we remember a lamb who was slain, a lamb whose body was broken and whose blood was applied to the doorposts of every Jewish home in Egypt. And when the judgment of death came into Egypt to free all of the Jewish people from their bondage and to bring the penalty of sin into Egypt, it was the blood of the lamb that was seen on the crossposts of the doors. If it was there, then this spirit of death would pass over the place. That's what we remember. Yeah, we understand. We're gathered to remember that. But today, this day, as they likely spit their unleavened cracker out of their mouths, this Jesus, the most famous guy in town, if he wanted to be the most powerful guy in town, if he wanted to be the guy that could be king in town, this day he says, I'm changing the whole story. This is no longer going to be about that. It is no longer going to be about the salvation of a nation. It's going to be about the salvation of everybody from everywhere. And it begins tonight, because from now on, this story is about me. It's about my body, which is being broken, not to save a religion and not to save a nation, but to save you, Rob. You, George. You, Loretta. Now, here's what we know. They didn't get it. In fact, what we know is that they didn't really get any of this stuff. They hadn't even wrapped their minds around the fact that Jesus was going to die for them. We know that because if you read the accounts, they're still arguing while he's doing this. They're arguing right there at the table over who's the greatest. But none of that stopped Jesus, because right after the dinner was over, in the same way, Luke writes, after the supper, he took the cup, saying, this cup is the new covenant. And so let's pause there. This is super important. Two fronts, two things you need to think through as Jesus says that. I know you've heard it a million times. This is the new covenant. Here's the first. They knew what this cup represented. This cup, there was a third cup, and you always took it at the end of the meal, right? There was actually four cups. This was the third cup, and it had the same script attached to it for 1,500 years. This was the third cup of the meal. It was the cup that reminded everyone of their redemption, of being bought back, of being, in a sense, purchased by the blood of the Lamb, out of their slavery in Israel. The cup represented the blood of the Lamb that was slain and put on the doorposts of every Jewish person in Egypt. It was how they were redeemed from their bondage and their slavery. It was what set them free. It was what began their rule as a nation and as a people. It was that blood that led them out of Egypt into the desert to Mount Sinai, where God gave his great commandments, where the law came to Moses, the lawgiver, where God established all of the pieces of this nation, the priests and the temple and the sacrificial system. They knew what the cup represented. It represented the redemption which underpinned the old covenant. And second, this one is a little harder for us. Again, we hear this word all the time. What is a covenant? And it's hard for us because in the world we currently live in, and the younger you are, the more true this is, in 21st century America, it's hard to understand what a covenant means because we talk about them a lot, but we rarely often find them. Covenants, we're not, that word, it sounds archaic, and maybe it seems archaic because we don't really have them anymore. Covenants were not exclusive to ancient Israel. They were common practice in ancient times. But what was exclusive to Israel was how God related to people through covenants. In fact, if you think about it this way, God is a covenantal God. It has always been how God relates to his people. Abraham, Adam, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, David. He's always relating to his people through a covenant. And what is a covenant? It is a premeditated, it is an ordered, it is a defined relationship. Now, in the 21st century, we hear that and it sounds kind of cold, right? Calculating. But please understand, it is the complete opposite. In the covenants that God creates with his people, they have two parts. The first is, in those covenants, there is deep intimacy. You look at the Mosaic covenant that they were all living under, right? Moses spoke of this covenant from God to his people, where God says, I will be their God. Not God. I'll be their God. And they will be my people. Not just, you know, they'll be people. No, they're mine. It's personal. God's covenant language was personal. It was not cold. It wasn't distant. It wasn't just some merely transactional legal thing. I am the Lord, not just God, but I am your God. You are not just people, but my people. But what you also see with God's covenant is there is within the covenant the language of law. They are sealed with an oath. So a covenant is a relationship more loving and more intimate than merely a legal relationship, but it is more binding and enduring and accountable than a mere personal relationship. Tim Keller calls it a stunning relationship between law and love. More stunning because it's a personal relationship made more loving and intimate because it's legal. Through voluntary, binding, mutual covenants and vows to be loving and faithful no matter what the circumstances. In our world, we rarely see this. Today, almost every relationship we get in has at its heart our fulfillment, our rights. Everything is a means towards this. I have a lot of friends that are attorneys, but this is why the entire business exists. Right? To ensure our protection. What's at the heart of every agreement today will be, I will be what I should be as long as and to the degree that you are what you should be. To the extent you perform, I perform. To the extent you don't perform, I won't perform. This covenant, this contract will be null and void. Covenants say, I will be what I should be regardless of what you do, if you do it or not. I'll still do it. And a covenant only works if both people commit to this. Otherwise, as you can imagine, it can become quite exploitive, abusive. But some of you know this because you're in exceptional marriages. If you get into a covenantal relationship where you both agree that your needs are more important than my needs, I am going to submit to one another out of reverence for love. I am going to submit my needs to your needs, right? And you both say it and do it, I will sacrifice for you no matter what you do for me. This is the most fulfilling and deep and profound relationship you can possibly have. It is so much different than a consumer relationship. Risky? Of course. Dangerous? Yeah. But if this is the most glorious, profound, fulfilling relationship, if they are all covenantal relationships, and think about it, if you get it right, If the marriage goes that way, think about the kind of unspoken covenantal relationship you have with your children, right? If the most beautiful relationships are covenantal relationships, wouldn't God's relationship with us have to be covenantal? And it's this picture of law and love that Jesus is speaking of when he says, this is a new one. I'm inaugurating a new covenant in my blood. See, covenants. Covenants, by their very nature, have terms and conditions. And in the ancient world, those terms and conditions were almost always exclusively, I know this sounds so primitive to us, but this is the way it is, or it is the way it was. They were exclusively sealed with blood. There was a ceremony. It was a very official ceremony, a very common ceremony, one that was well known in the day, one that would make us turn our heads away today. See, today, like if somebody breaks one of our agreements, today in the 21st century, I mean, you have documents and you could call 911. We have police and lawyers and jails and damages and judges. In ancient times, there weren't any such things. And so covenants were often sealed in blood. They were like blood promises. And so what was common in order to seal a covenant, right? When a covenant was established, there was sacrifice involved. Animals were sacrificed, and their blood was shed. The animals' bodies were broken. They were torn apart. They were actually, this is so fascinating. You can go home and read about this. You could teach an entire class on covenants. There's all kinds of different covenants, right? These covenants were sealed. They would take animals, they would sacrifice them, they would literally rip them in two, and they would create two rows. And the parties to the covenants would walk through the rows, bodies broken, blood everywhere. And they would walk between the two rows of the sacrificed animals. And as they walked, they would be pronouncing, sometimes verbally, I would imagine, but always symbolically, committing that they would, if they do not uphold their end of the bargain, may they become like one of these animals. Should I violate my end of the covenant, may I become like these. They were accepting the same, in a sense, destruction if they broke the deal. By the way, this is what the word covenant means, to cut. And this is where we get the saying, to cut a deal. This is the concept. This is where it came from. Now, a little bit of history. If you're Jewish, you might know this. This is fascinating stuff. When God establishes this covenant with Abraham, the covenant that establishes the Jewish people, some of you know the story. God promised Abraham. He just comes to Abraham and he says, I am choosing you. I am going to turn you. I'm going to make you the father of a great nation. You're going to have children, right? And they're going to outnumber the stars in the sky. But Abraham had been childless. In fact, Abraham was childless. And Abraham, after this promise, was childless for some amount of time. And his childbearing years had drawn to a close, and so had his wives. And so Abraham goes to God and goes, I am not sure about this promise you made me anymore. I'm not sure I can rely on this promise. Do you know what God tells him to do? I want you to go, and I want you to get me a heifer and a goat and a ram. Now you and I go, well, what? But Abraham understood what that meant. He must have stood in awe because he knew what it meant. This is how big a deal this was. This is how common covenants were in the ancient world, because when he goes and gets them, he does not ask God what to do with them. Abraham brings them back, and here's what the scripture says. Abraham brought all these to him, cut them in two, and arranged the halves opposite each other. And he sets up the rows, and he thinks to himself, well, God's going to want me to walk through there and promise him something so that he'll make, so that I'll be the father of, you know, I'm going to have to do something, right? Abraham's figuring he's got to cut a deal with God, just like I do, just like you do. I don't know what he's going to want from me, but he's going to want something, and I'm going to have to walk the line there, right? It's not what happens. Genesis 15 says, as the sun was setting, Abraham fell into a deep sleep, and a thick dread darkness came over him. This
this darkness of judgment kind of comes over the scene. And in that darkness, the scripture says that God appeared and walked through the pieces. And then was Abraham, I can't believe God is going to bind himself to an agreement with man. I wonder what he's going to want from Abraham. I guess Abraham's going to have to get up and walk through too. And then God left the scene. That was it. Abraham was not called to walk through them. God was taking the covenant on himself. In the story, God commits to upholding both ends of the deal. Even if Abraham fails to do his part, even if Abraham fails to perform, God will not walk. God will be faithful. Is there something bigger going on in that original story? Of course there is. Abraham is beginning to be invited to trust God, to believe that he is good and has Abraham's best interests in mind and will be faithful to Abraham, even if Abraham were to make a mess of everything. Fast forward to Jesus, who now says, this cup of redemption, it represents the new covenant in my blood. Here's my role in this. I'll be the one torn in two. I'll be the one who will pay the price, because I am going to bless you. I'm going to save you, and I am going to be held to this covenant forever. But Jesus goes on, he goes, this new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you, and I will be the only one who walks the rows. And God, once again, like he had centuries earlier with Abraham, once again, he establishes a new covenant, and it is not like the old one. This would not be an if-then covenant. It would not be a performance-related covenant. This would be unlike the Mosaic covenant, which was reliant on both parties. Once again, God shows up in the form of a lamb, and he pronounces a new covenant in his blood, poured out for us. Stunningly, once again, saying, I will subject myself to the penalty if you don't live up to it. I will love you, I will bless you, I will forgive you, no matter what you do, even if it means I must be torn apart to ensure that it happens. And he was. Because a couple of days later, darkness came over the world and judgment again. And Luke tells us, it was now about noon, and darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m, for the sun stopped shining. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two. The thing that had separated God from man in the temple was no more. Why? Because the thing that had separated God from man was no longer sin. God had chose to allow himself to be torn in two, to pay the price for you and I, to accept the price of the covenant, the one we had broken by our sin in order to bless us and forgive us. In fact, Matthew would write it this way. He has Jesus saying it this way. This is the blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. So let me ask you a question. Tried to cut any deals with God lately? God, if you would, then I would. Or maybe try to control him, right? Like, if you would do this, God, then I would. Funny, there's two ways that you can walk away from God, right? One is just to say, forget it. All he wants is just to take stuff away from me, to demand of me, right? And that's a total misunderstanding of what Jesus came to do. And you can walk away from God because of that. And you can also walk away from God. I mean, this is older brother, younger brother stuff. And you can also walk away from God by trying to control him through kind of going back to the old covenant, trying to cut yourself a deal with God. There's two ways. You can disobey or you can obey. So what do you do? Or you do what John said over and over. I want you to see. I want you to receive. And I want you to believe. There is a new relationship between God and humans, and it is not based on anything you can do any longer. It is purely based on your desire to be in it. And if you desire to be in it, he will put a new heart in you,
and he will write the rules of the relationship on your heart. And when you screw them up, it won't matter because he will have paid the price already for your screw-ups. The only question is, do you see? Do you believe? And will you receive? Are there terms and conditions? Yeah, we'll talk about them next week. It's amazing. But even when you screw them up, Jesus walked through the row by himself. Let's stand and close the song.